This is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 18. This week, I'm pleased to be talking with Andrea Bemis, a young farmer living in Oregon. Andrea's story is one of transformation, from a city girl who had never even cut the grass, to having her courage and determination thoroughly tested in her early days as a farm worker, to now operating her very own 6-acre organic farm with her husband. Her story is one that is often fantasized about by people who feel trapped in the city, isolated from nature, who yearn to dig into the earth and just live a simpler life. It sounds nice, but as Andrea learned, the going is hard. And yet, not only has she persevered, she's fallen in love. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast. Welcome to another week on the Pure Green Podcast. We have another really great interview lined up for you today. I'm talking with Andrea Bemis, who operates a small farm called Tumbleweed Farm with her husband, Taylor. I personally have a lot of respect for farmers. I'm sure you've seen them around, but every time I spot a bumper sticker that says, "Farmers feed cities," I smile, happy that messages like that are being spread. I spend an inordinate amount of time thinking about where food comes from. The issues surrounding food and its production are so thickly intertwined with the planet and our health, and it can be hard to decipher sometimes. The age of the independent farm is in trouble. With less and less young farmers taking up the torch, the cost and risk is high, and the lifestyle very hard. It was for all these reasons that I jumped at the chance to talk with Andrea, who originally emailed me just to say how much she was enjoying the podcast during her tedious spring seeding. I wanted to know the story of her farm, how it was going, and gain a deeper understanding on what the landscape looks like for young farmers today. In the episode, Andrea talks in detail about the hardship of her start in farming and the hardships she and Taylor continue to face. She cautions those who romanticize the idea, but despite the challenges, her outlook is positive. She talks about how she fell in love with the sensation of being physically exhausted each day, so different from the fatigue of working at a desk or even from exercising recreationally. She also talks of the incredible rewards of feeding over 50 families with their summer CSA boxes. As she says, it's the proudest she's ever felt. And of course, we talk about Dishing Up the Dirt, her blog, how she learned to cook using all these exotic veggies, and why she created it in the first place. Her emphasis is on farm-to-table cooking, and she shares a lot of ideas on using up all those early season greens. Let's go to the interview. Here's Andrea.
Okay, so just before we jump in, I just want to say thank you once again for taking the time to come on and to talk with me. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
And it was really fun to discover your blog because I feel as though I perhaps had come across it before, but it was felt new to me and I totally loved it. I love what you're doing. Your photography is beautiful, so it was really great.
Oh, thank you.
I'll be a regular reader.
Awesome.
Okay, so I wondered if we could start off with you just giving us a little bit about you and your background.
Well, my background, I'm from Portland, Oregon, originally, and my young adult life sort of took me all over the place from Colorado to New York City, Boston, back to Bend, Oregon. Lived in Montana for a while, which is actually where I met my husband. And that was about 11 years ago this past summer. And we both moved to the East Coast. He was finishing school in up in Maine, and I was in New York City, and we kind of did some long distance. But he grew up on an organic farm in Massachusetts. And him and I kind of bounced around together for about 5 years before we decided that we wanted to move back to his folks' farm in Massachusetts to learn sort of the farming ropes, which was totally new to me. I grew up, you know, in a suburban town outside of Portland and never mowed the lawn or anything like that. Nothing. Did not have a green thumb. So moving to the farm was quite a culture shock, I guess you could say. And that was in 2008, I believe, we moved back to Massachusetts, and kind of rolled up our sleeves and got to work on this 60-acre organic vegetable farm with a crew of about 15 other people. And I absolutely hated it.
Okay.
Yeah, I had this sort of vision that that farming would be super romantic and that we would be plucking carrots from the ground and the days would be, you know, long and lovely, but it was hectic and we started in the early spring and it was freezing and wet and we kind of worked for a drill sergeant, which was not my father-in-law. It was the farm manager. Mm-hmm. And it took me a couple of months to start to get into it. But it was a lot of hard work. I had never done physical labor. So it was, that was years ago. And now we're still doing it.
Yeah. So something must have changed along the way. So I wanted to touch on a few things that you said there. So one, you said that, you know, you had no previous experience, never having even mowed the lawn type of thing, which I'm sure you did a little, but it's kind of like, you know, you weren't familiar with the trade at all. So what drew you to even give it a try in the first place?
Well, we were, my husband, his name's Taylor, we were at the time living in Bend, Oregon, when we made the decision that we wanted to venture back east to give farming a go. And it was actually, we both love the outdoors. I was into running. I was working at a running shop. I was 25. I'm 31 now. So I was 25. He was a ski bum working on, the mountain, and we loved Bend and what we were doing, but we just sort of were kind of getting tired of the paycheck to paycheck, just living to have fun. His father, who is one of the owners of this farm back east, it was late August, and I remember every year he sends us this big box of blueberries from their orchard, and we got this box of blueberries, and we put a baggie of them, and we were on a hike, and we were eating these blueberries, and just started talking about the farm, and you know, we were kind of at that crossroads in life where we didn't really know what, you know, we wanted to be when we grew up. I don't know. We both had educations, but we weren't that fulfilled. And I had slowly kind of gotten into cooking, not really, but I was starting to pay more attention to where my food was coming from. And on a whim, on a hike, while sort of eating these blueberries, I was like, gosh, what if we gave farming a go? And Taylor was like really surprised that I wanted to, or that I'd even mentioned that, because he had actually silently been sort of dreaming of it, of going back home and working the farm, but was too nervous to bring it up to me because he thought I would definitely say no. And so we decided that we would sit on it for a couple of weeks before, you know, mentioning it to his father, because we knew if we told his father would say, come out now. And actually, instead of waiting a couple of weeks, we got back from this hike and called his dad and said we'd love to come and work for him. And we packed up our bags a couple of months later and drove east.
So you just jumped right in. And basically, I love that. And it's nice, you know, that the experience of eating those blueberries, it was sort of made the connection to you, you know, of where your food comes from. And just, you know, blueberries are so good and everybody loves them. And so it kind of plays into that romantic notion that you were talking about earlier.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were really good blueberries.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally those visions of like, oh, we can be plucking blueberries from the bushes. And I had, my visions were very romantic at first.
Mm-hmm. And so then the real motivator was just a search for purpose and just being unsure of where your life would go at this point. So you just, you know, because you had this opportunity, you wanted to just take it and to give it a try.
Right.
Right. So, you know, you talk about the preconception that you had of farming, you know, that, you know, this romantic notion of it. And I think that that's actually quite common. I think that, people often romanticize about leaving the big city, getting their hands dirty. You know, really, that experience is somewhat sought after. But for you, you know, it was a big wake-up call. So you kind of touched on it briefly, but I was wondering if you could just get into that a little bit more. So what were your early days like, and when did things start to shift for you? Because, you know, you're still doing it now, so obviously something changed.
Yeah, I guess I really remember our first day on the farm, and we were pruning blueberry bushes. This was in the early spring, the very beginning of April, and it was our first day. And his dad is wonderful, and you know, we got the gear, boots, pocket knife. I had never, you know, I couldn't even figure out how to get my pocket knife like out. Like I was, you know, loppers, all this stuff that I was like, what am I doing? Who am I trying to be? I do not, you know, these clothes are too big on me. And I felt totally uncomfortable, but it was our first day. It was like a mixture of snow and rain. And when we woke up, I was like, oh, well, Taylor, I mean, we don't work in this weather, right? And he was like, you know, yeah, we do. And we quickly learned that it doesn't matter if it's 110 degrees outside or if it's minus 10 degrees outside. It was a working farm that had customers and had timelines, and we had to kind of work through any conditions. And yeah, I remember just kind of that first day almost being on the brink of tears all day because, you know, we were expected to do, you know, 3 acres of blueberries and, you know, a week's worth of time. And there was only a couple of us. So I didn't really know what I was doing. And I was questioning every cut that I made. And I just felt totally out of my element. And I was freezing. And I just, that first day was not a highlight, but each morning, we'd wake up and, you know, kind of keep going, and slowly the chores changed, and we were harvesting early spring vegetables, once we started harvesting, that was when the connection really started to happen, where it was pretty awesome, you know, being able to go home and with all this stuff that we'd picked for the day, and, you know, kind of learning how to cook too, which I hadn't done, but I don't know, it was a slow progression. I went from hating it to being like, this isn't so bad, to loving it. And one thing that I love even to this day is I used to be a real night owl and had a hard time sleeping, and I had never finished a day of work and just crawled into bed and felt so completely exhausted. Just my muscles hurt. I felt totally beat up, and I loved that. There was something pretty powerful about having like actually worked my whole body working and being physically tired from the day, and not just, I don't know. I hadn't experienced that, and I kind of became addicted to that feeling. Just the winter time, you know, we don't work as hard, and I tend to sleep, or my sleeping pattern is all off in the winter. And I don't know, that pure exhaustion feeling was something that I grew to really like.
I love that you said that, because I think, you know, so many of us, myself included, spend most of our time sitting. Like, I'm working on a computer most of the day. And so I look to other things. Like, I intentionally go outside for a walk. Other people go to the gym. But we have to find these pseudo-artificial ways of exercising our bodies. And what you're talking about, this pure sense of physical exhaustion, I mean, that's going back to our roots. I mean, that's truly what humans were meant to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I mean, and I used to sit, you know, at a desk too, and also just, yeah, same thing where I would try and fit in a run and that would be my workout for the day, which is great, but it's still, I remember coming in from work being exhausted from just being brain dead, I guess. And it's kind of, yeah, the physical exhaustion is sort of a different feeling that I hadn't been used to. And then really, yeah, it's sort of rewarding in a weird way, kind of feeling beat up, but liking it. I don't know if that sounds weird, but.
No, it doesn't at all. I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I think as a culture, a lot of us suffer from decision-making fatigue, you know, especially I'm a mom now, and I find that the small decisions I have to make all day just add up to the point where I feel so tired, but really it's my brain that's sluggish. And then when it's time to go to bed, I find that I can't fall asleep. And it's because it's a different type of tiredness. It's not the same. And I used to work on a horse farm when I was younger. That was a big, huge part of my life. It's what I thought I wanted to do. And I would get up and I would go, I would ride, like, I don't know, anywhere from 7 to 10 horses in a day. I'd get off one, I'd get handed another, and we just train all day long. And by the end of the day, it's just, you can't go on for a minute longer, but it's pleasant, like, right, because your brain is actually quite at peace. You know, you just feel very calm, and all you could think about is bed, and you just crawl in. It feels so good, and you're just right out, and it's so nice.
Totally, like when you work till you have nothing left to give.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. How many years did you do that for?
Well, I started when I was about 17, I think. I went as a working student on a farm, and from there I got the opportunity to work on more and more prestigious farms until I was riding and working with a member of the Canadian show jumping Olympic team. And so he'd been to the Olympics 6 times, and I did that for a couple of years. It was really hard, though, and it wasn't even because of the physical part of it. It was more just the politics of, you know, that sort of elite level,
right,
of sport.
Totally.
So, yeah. So I kind of had enough of that and came home. And I still have my horse. I don't see her often enough, but I still have her.
Okay.
So.
Oh, sweet. What's her name?
Yeah. Her name's Annie. Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, she's an Irish warm blood.
Awesome.
Yeah. Okay, so shifting back a little bit, for you, you know, you said harvesting was the shift, and I think that's really lovely, because that's when you see the fruit of your labor start to happen. Mm-hmm. And by then the weather's getting warmer and things just get a little more, you know, easier as you go along. And I think that's the part, like you said, that's the part that really makes the connection for so many people. And I think that is what people really, you know, romanticize about when they think about all of this.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I remember the first stuff that was coming up, you know, spring greens and parsnips and again, but I was a dose of reality. You know, we had about a crew of 15 of us, but it was a 60-acre farm, and I remember, too, learning really fast the hard way. We would fill these crates of, you know, carrots and parsnips, but we would, you know, park the trucks at the end of these, you know, 500-feet-long rows and, you know, filling these crates. And I remember filling my crate to the top and being like, oh, no, how am I, you know, this is 70 pounds of carrots. How am I going to walk this, you know, 150 feet down this road to the truck? I'm not the biggest person in the world. And also, God forbid, I mean, you can't at the farm, you can't ask for help. You don't ask somebody else to carry your crate. So, I learned quickly to, you know, fill mine half full, walk it, dump it into the other big bin and go back and forth. But yeah, learning these small little tricks along the way and working quickly. That was one thing that part of my romantic vision of being on a farm was not, was like, oh, it's this slow pace and on a working farm, it's go, 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 go. So, that's, you know, part of the exhaustion, but it's good to test yourself. And I remember feeling pretty proud once I finally was like, I'm getting stronger and, you know, doing things that I didn't, that I totally doubted I physically could do. And it was kind of neat to see that sort of transform as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you said, did you say that the 60 acres is pretty big? Did you say that it was an organic farm?
Yes, it was an organic farm.
Okay. So you're actually pulling things out of the, I don't know why, but when I think about big farms like that, I think everything's mechanized. There's machinery to do all of that. But no, like you're actually pulling things out of the earth with your own two hands.
We were, although on, and it was Hutchins Farm in Concord, Massachusetts. They had, I mean, they definitely had a lot of tractors. I mean, now it's funny, we're on a smaller farm and the work is actually harder because we have less equipment, but we would be pulling things, we'd be harvesting them, but they would all, like the carrots and beets, a lot of things would get undercut first so that they were a little bit easier to pull up, whereas now we're digging them with, you know, shovels and forks by hand at our farm now. But there was tractor work, but a lot of stuff was still done by hand.
Okay. So you mentioned, just go in this direction now because you just briefly mentioned that you're on a different farm now. And so readers of your blog know that, but I wondered if you could maybe tell us about that transition, why you decided to leave, you know, because one of the sort of ideas or, you know, limited knowledge they have about farming is that it's often passed down. So like there are truly family run farms that span generations. And that seems to be, you know, a common way of doing it because there's less entry barriers, probably. Like you can inherit the land or you can, you know, like as opposed to having to start fresh. So why did you make that decision?
It was actually a really tough decision because of exactly what you said. My husband grew up on this farm and a lot of family lives there. But there's a lot of family involved in the farm. And we kind of had this idea. I'm from Oregon originally. And my husband is a big skier, downhill skier, and he does love skiing, so that also will come into play in a minute. But we worked on Hutchins for 3 years, and we did year round because in the winter time there we did a lot of pruning in the orchards. But we had this idea that we really wanted to start our own. It would have been hard and easy at the same time to have. It was an established farm. It was successful. It was making money. And we kind of got to step in and just pick up where, you know, where we wanted. And we kind of would always imagine how amazing his dad and uncle must feel when they drive along the farm and just see what it is today. It's amazing. All of their hard work is this awesome, successful, beautiful farm. There was a part of us that didn't totally feel like, not that we weren't worthy of it, but that we didn't put in the time to get it to where it was. And there is something incredibly powerful about starting something. I don't know. We had this desire to, and we also had a desire to scale down a little bit. But we really did want our own operation eventually. And specifically, we do really love the East Coast, but felt a strong connection to Oregon and Mount Hood, which is, we live really close to Mount Hood right now. And it was a hard decision to leave the farm, but we really did sort of want to scale down and kind of be our own smaller operation.
Okay. So, First of all, before I want to ask you, like, what makes a farm successful? Like when you said, you know, like a farm of that operation, of that size, and because I mean, farming, it's a tricky situation. And so in that case where things are operating smoothly and it's a successful farm, what does that look like?
It's making money, I guess. It's sustaining itself. They're able to and then for us, even if they had a bad year, they were still able to pay us, which is actually different than from what we're dealing with now. But they had a really strong following, and they were making money. It was in the town of Concord, Massachusetts, and the farms stand, you know, every day, lines out the door. They did farmers markets and restaurants, and they were, and I didn't do the books at that farm, so I don't totally know, I don't know what they grossed in a year, and but they success, I guess, would be, and even for us now, we consider a successful farm to be one that's making money and that we're able to actually have a little bit of a livelihood off of.
But what is the so the main avenue for the produce was still fairly independent. So it was going out through farmers markets and directly from the farm,
yes,
as opposed to like a middleman, a distributor of some kind,
yes,
through to. Yeah. Okay. So that sounds like it's maybe somewhat of a key point, probably.
Yes. And then because you can charge more. And you're getting more, you're getting what you're, you know, what it should be. Yes, exactly.
Right. Okay. So then you made the decision to go to start your own farm. And I can appreciate what you're talking about, you know, the reward of growing something from scratch. It's that, you know, that there is value in that. It seems like, well, maybe not. It seems like maybe it was the harder way to go, but.
it was. The thing, and we're very lucky, when we left, we were under, we had a safety net of we can always go back. If we leave, we saved up money and we were like, okay, if in 1 year out in Oregon, it doesn't work. And we didn't buy land at first. We leased land. We played it pretty safely because we had never grown out here. We'd only been farming for 3 years. We were still really new, didn't know if we had it in us. So we left Hutchins and they said, you know, if it doesn't work out, but I think some of them were like, we kind of hope it doesn't work out. Come back. But we were very lucky. And even to this day, if Tumbleweed were to catch on fire today, we always have a place back there, which is awesome, you know, feels good. But we're also have fallen in love with what we're doing out here that I think that we'll stay. But yes, we were lucky that we had the opportunity to try branching out on our own, knowing that, okay, if we fail, we can go back.
Mm-hmm. So how did you go about finding your own farm in Oregon?
So we, there's actually a website called iFarm. And we're in the, we live in the gorge. We live outside of Hood River, Oregon, in a little town called Parkdale. And we knew that we wanted to be kind of near Mount Hood, so in the wintertime we could have good access to skiing, but also the Hood River Valley has a lot of agriculture, mainly pears and apple orchards. But we found through this website a family that had a 2-acre plot that they were trying to lease to have people farm it because they weren't using it. And so we were really lucky. It was the first place we looked at. It was the right price to lease the land, and the couple was really lovely. And so we didn't live on the farm then. So we were driving. We rented a house in Hood River and would drive up every day, which I don't recommend. It It's hard to not live on the actual land. We camped out quite a bit, actually. But, so we leased that land for 1 year just to see if this area we would be able to grow successful crops and if the soil was good and if also if we could do it on our own. It was just a test year, I guess. And we did okay. And so we decided we wanted to stay, but we really wanted to start looking for land to purchase. And we actually found a place about 2 miles down the road from where we were leasing, and were able to buy land really close to where we'd been doing our trial year.
Okay, and so your new farm is 6 acres?
It's 6 acres, yes.
Yeah, okay. So what were the main differences farming in Oregon versus where you were before?
I would say, well, I mean, I guess, I mean, climate-wise, it actually isn't, well, actually, I will say this. Ironically, even though Oregon is more of a rainy state, it does not rain in the summer here. Irrigating is, we move irrigation every 2 hours. Like in the summertime, we have timers on, like every 2 hours, we have to go out and like move all of the sprinklers around. Whereas in Massachusetts, you know, it would rain every couple days. And so irrigating sort of has taken over our lives. But as far as growing crops, we are able to grow pretty much the same varieties of vegetables as we did back east. The main difference is that it's just the two of us. We're making the seeding schedule. We don't have as robust of a barn full of equipment as we did back there. And you sort of take that for granted. We don't even own, you know, pitchforks or hoes or, you know, we kind of forgot about the basic things that we had there that, you know, we had to go and purchase and all that adds up and tractor equipment, you know. Yeah, we kind of are doing more things by hand. So that's the main difference. We didn't really realize how easy we had it. and we thought that was hard. So
yeah,
but no, and each year we're learning, you know, more and more. But we, I guess the main difference is we're doing a lot more by hand out here.
Okay, but I don't know why, but I'm surprised that the growing season is so similar.
It's shorter. Our growing season's definitely shorter by a.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that is, we're able to grow a lot of the same types of vegetables, but our growing season is, we're at a little bit of altitude where we are. So our growing season is, starts a little later and ends a little sooner by probably, I would say, like about 3 weeks on each end.
Okay. Which is tricky in and of itself. I mean, where I live, I live in Ontario in Canada, and our growing season is crazy short. You know, okay. It's sort of like from June to like maybe a middle of September.
Yes. I think that. Yeah. Eating tomatoes at like the very end of like September. And then don't you have a very short tomato season?
Oh, you know, the people who grow tomatoes successfully here do it in a greenhouse,
yes.
Which we don't have.
Yes.
And this year, actually, I was so frustrated with growing things, and then honestly, every single plant in the garden would come to fruition at the same time. Like end of August, we'd be like inundated with stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then for like June, July, we had nothing. And so this is my first year to be like, okay, you know what? I'm going to get really organized. I'm going to start seeds indoors. So
I saw that on the website.
Yeah.
And that's awesome. Nice work.
Yeah. So we're giving it a try, and I'm really going to do a lot more research as well into succession planting too, just to try and maximize that yield, because I don't know what's happening with food right now. Well, I do know. I know all of the reasons, but it just seems like it's been a really drastic change here. Like, the availability of organic is like almost zero, and then the expense of food is just through the roof. And so I'm feeling super committed to getting this garden as productive as possible.
And succession is key too. So that, yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. So you're not just one big harvest and being like, whoa,
yeah.
What do I do with all this?
Yeah, exactly. And then also to try and, you know, for certain things that you pull out of the ground and then it's done, I'm going to try and have more coming up as seedlings. So on like I think it's a 2 or 3 week sort of rotation, I think, or lapse. I don't know. I need to do a lot more research.
Right.
Yeah. So then for you, your early days were, you know, just a bit of a wake-up call, but then how did things shape up? So what do things look like now?
Things look, I guess now, you know, we're still, I mean, every year we're still figuring out what we're doing. But we feel like we have a better understanding of just our growing season, what we're able to grow, especially with like our business, what grows well, what our customers want. And we do a CSA farm. So we sell to a farmer's market, a couple of restaurants, but then our main source of income is our CSA, which is community supported agriculture. And so we have 50 members and we grow, food that once a week we give them a box of about a week's worth of vegetables, and we drive actually into the city of Portland, which is about an hour and a half from us. And so we now, when we do our seeding schedule and we're picking our seeds, we're mainly doing it for the CSA. So that kind of, they influence sort of what we grow, so that we can make sure that they get like a nice variety in their boxes. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's still sometimes a wake up call. I mean, sometimes I'll still, you know, be out there in the middle of a storm or camping out in the greenhouse early spring when we're afraid that the heater's not working, just to like monitor the temperature. And I'll have these moments of like, when did this become my life? but it's just been a pretty powerful change, I guess. Never been more proud of anything I've done before, which is a good feeling. And yeah, I don't know. The people that we've met along the way, especially out here in Oregon, have been really inspiring, specifically our customers and our members that are supporting us. They're total rock stars, because we wouldn't be able to make a living if it weren't for them. And so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I mean, CSAs, I'm always a part of a CSA here, and I'm trying a new one this year. So I'm really looking forward to that, because our garden's too small to like completely feed us. I don't have the time mostly to keep it up.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. But how many members do you have?
We have 50 members.
Okay, that's pretty good.
We did it last year, and we're capping it at that. We're definitely at our max.
Well, yeah, because preparing all that and even just packaging it up, 50 is a lot.
We go on Tuesday mornings, and Tuesdays are the craziest day of the week. I don't know how we have survived every Tuesday. But somehow we have.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So then do you run your CSA so that people, they pay upfront, and then which helps get the farm started, and that, because at the beginning of the season is where you need your seed money.
Yes.
Right?
So it's where we need all of our seed money and equipment money. And so, yes, we do. We have people pay there to secure their spot. And it's funny that you mentioned that. We're actually right now collecting all of that right now. So we have people do a $100 deposit just to secure their spot. And then on the first delivery day, the full amount, the remaining amount is due.
Okay.
And our CSA, like I said, we're a little bit of a shorter season. We start going to the farmers markets actually before our CSA starts. And our CSA is the first Tuesday in June through November.
Okay. So one question that I'm curious about is, you know, what is your opinion on seeds? Like, I've heard a lot of talk about, you know, heirloom is so valued and, you know, for good reason. People really talk about that and wanting to preserve sort of these older strains that aren't, you know, genetically modified or whatever. But one of the things that I've heard talked about from a farmer's perspective is that heirloom seeds aren't always the best in terms of yield. And sometimes they're more susceptible to certain things like drag or heat or pests. I don't know. So what is your opinion on that?
We do a mix of heirloom and hybrids, and yeah, there's great things with both. And I don't have, I mean, I don't, and we don't grow any genetically modified seeds or anything like that. But especially with our heirloom tomatoes, they're awesome. They don't yield nearly as well as a lot of our hybrids. And we're going to continue to grow them, but they're, you know, we like to, with anything, we keep a mix. We grow, when we order seeds, we order about 15% more than what we know we need, because we have to account for that, for diseases or for poor yields. But yeah, I'm, you know, heirloom seeds are great, but hybrids are awesome as well. And I have nothing against hybrids. We have a mix of, we order a mix of both. We can sell our heirloom tomatoes for a little bit more than our hybrids, but that's because they're a little more difficult to grow and the seeds are a lot more expensive.
Oh, are they? That's interesting. Okay, so we've been talking about farming for a little while now, and I'm so interested in it. I could ask you questions forever, but I wanted to transition to your blog as well and to the relationship between farm-to-table cooking and the recipes that you develop and all of that. So at what point did you even come up with the idea of blogging and developing recipes and sharing them?
Well, the blog was sort of, not accidental, but when we were back east, I had never really been, you know, I started the blog basically to show my dad, like, look what I'm doing, you know, I'm out in the dirt, filthy. I knew he would never believe that, like, I couldn't leave the house without a pocket knife and that I was filthy, dirty, and, and so I kind of started the blog for my parents and my family kind of back home so they could see what we were doing. And my mom was a cook when I was growing up, but I could barely boil a pot of water for pasta. And I just wanted them to sort of see with their own eyes, because I knew they wouldn't believe it, that I was kind of slowly, you know, transforming. And so I started kind of blogging for them. And it was cute. You know, it was just like my mom, my sister, my dad, my brother were probably the only four people that were reading the blog for the first year or so. But, I, especially with Taylor, we were growing all these vegetables back east. I had no idea what they were. I didn't grow up eating kohlrabi or rutabagas or beets. And we would spend hours, you know, weeding, or we would be harvesting, you know, hundreds of pounds of beets, and our backs would be killing us. And I'm like, we need to learn to eat this and love it, because we're working so hard to grow it. There must be something to this. And we're going to learn to love it. And so we would go home, and the place we lived on the farm back east was tiny. It was like 250 square feet, if that. I mean, it was just this little shoebox of a house, with a tiny kitchen. But, you know, we would go home with, you know, with beets and, you know, fennel, and I'd be like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to either grill this or burn it, or I don't know. But we just slowly were like, okay, we're gonna learn to love this food. And it, you know, slowly we did. At first it wasn't always successful, but, and then I would be showing, you know, pictures to my parents. I was taking photos, all my photos at the beginning of the blog are so embarrassing that they're all taken with my iPhone. And, but it turned into, it was kind of fun. We'd be out in the fields, like it'd be 100 degrees out, and be like, man, I wonder what would be good with these beets. And we'd be kind of delusional talking about what we were going to cook for dinner. And, I don't know. So that's sort of how the blog came about, was, you know, just kind of showing my folks what we were up to. And then it was kind of fun to document some recipes and reference them to make them again. And so that's sort of how that started. And it sort of evolved, when we, and then eventually I ended up getting quite a few followers back east that sort of followed our transition from being on Hutchins Farm to leasing land to then buying our own land. I have some sweet followers that I've never met that have just sort of been with us for the last, I guess I've been blogging for 5 years. So, but now the blog has taken on a whole other, we rely on our customers to still be inspired with their CSA boxes. And so I'm really committed to keeping the recipes interesting, because, you know, each week they might be getting kale for 4 weeks in a row, and I don't want them to look and be like, oh my God, kale again, what am I supposed to do with this? So I like to keep the recipes interesting so that, even if I'm using the same ingredients quite a bit, just so that people are inspired to really cook through their boxes. And not get too sick of what they have, because if they're not stoked on the CSA, then we lose a member, and that we can't afford to do that. So I try and make the blog and the CSA sort of intertwine quite a bit. And I don't know.
Yeah, that is, so it sounds like both of you, like it was a process that you and Taylor went through together to learn how to cook with, because I mean, he grew up on that farm, so he must have been a bit more familiar than you were.
Well, ironically, I would think so.
Yeah.
So his father's a farmer, his mom isn't, and she never wanted him to like feel the pressure to actually like work on the farm. And ironically, he didn't really grow up even working on the farm much. Like he would do unskilled labor, like picking blueberries or things like that for like summer job. But he didn't know what kohlrabi was or fennel. He didn't grow up eating beets. I was like, what?
Yeah, that's so surprising.
I was like, gosh, if we ever had kids, they'd be growing up with all this. But yeah, he didn't, it was funny. He did not grow up eating that. And he actually is not a huge cook. I do most of the cooking, but he's like a meat and potatoes guy, but he happily has kind of turned, he's not a vegetarian, and actually I'm not either, even though I have a mainly vegetarian blog, but he pretty much is stoked with just anything that I cook. I always think he's being nice, but he goes back for seconds and thirds quite a bit. But yeah, he's not a big cook, but he, you know, he'll eat anything.
Okay, that's funny. But you know, for some reason I do have this like idea of farmers being meat and potatoes kind of guys, but maybe I'm thinking more of like a livestock farm.
Totally. Yeah.
I don't know.
And we'd probably be more meat and potatoes people if we had livestock. We have chickens, but we just do lane chickens, and
yeah.
I don't know, but yeah, he's like a pretty simple man. I get in the kitchen, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go crazy and try and get sometimes a little too creative. And he's just, you know, throw it on the grill and he's good to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's something to be said for that too sometimes. But I really love the direction that you've gone in now with your blog serving a dual purpose. I mean, you have this sort of virtual following, but then you also have, you know, real customers that you have a real relationship with. And I think it's fantastic, actually, to have recipe suggestions for, you know, for your basket, because I've lived that experience. You know, the CSA that we get, you know, literally, I'm just like, okay, so I've got collard greens and I've got, you know, beans and I have baby potatoes for, like, I feel like half the time.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm just like, okay, I need some, you know, even though, like, my husband, Jonathan, he's the food editor for Pure Green and he's an amazing cook and he can just craft things out of thin air where I can't. I need a recipe, but he's super, super busy. So, you know, we've been having to share the cooking. And I just don't know what to do with it. So I'm sure your customers find it so helpful.
I think they do, which is great. Cause we've gotten, we ask for feedback, you know, every year, and the recipes, we've gotten a lot of really positive feedback about how that is really helpful. And because, I mean, I'm the same one, like, it's such a challenge. You know, I've thought about, would I join a CSA if, you know, if I wasn't growing, you know, if we weren't farmers, would we, and we didn't have a garden, like, would I join a CSA? And part of me is like, I don't know if I would. And then, you know, maybe I'd go to the farmer's market, but because of that challenge of not knowing what you're going to get and also not knowing if we're going to get anything, or if it's just going to be a big box of greens again. And that's where it's, I mean, and I've gotten really pretty, I think I've gotten pretty good about the recipe suggestions, and I have a 101 ways to prepare, you know, collard greens. So if you're ever in a stump, just shoot me an email. But yeah, I don't know. That's why I love our members, because it is a challenge. And they're kind of amazing for taking up the challenge with us. But yeah, and for me, it's just really important that, you know, I don't know. And then it's also heartbreaking if you know, like, that the box, you know, goes to waste because
all
the work that went into just, you know, growing it and assembling those boxes. And you want people to really enjoy the food and hopefully they do and don't get too overwhelmed with it.
Yeah. I think it's really important to note as well that with the CSA, it's only half, honestly, about the food that you get. At least for me, I think that the other half is knowing where your food comes from and knowing that you're supporting a small farm, helping them just to make it.
Right.
You know, like, that is just so critical. And I think in this day and age, depending on how you eat, we just have such a disconnected relationship with where our food comes from, which was part of the reason I was so excited to interview you, is because I hope that people are starting to realize that food is a finite resource. And, you know, one of the main knowledge that I have, which is super limited, is from a book that I read called Locavore by Sarah Elton. It's focused on the Canadian farming industry, but it paints a pretty grim picture. Like, it's rooted in positiveness, but still, like, she, you know, like, the average age of farmers in Canada is around 55.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of left wondering, well, who's going to grow our food? And when you read about the challenges that young farmers are facing, or farmers generally, it's kind of super scary.
Yeah, it's grim.
Yeah. So I'm like, do you have a network of sort of young farmers that are, that you know, or are you kind of...
We do.
Okay, that's good.
Yes, we do, which is actually pretty awesome. The area that we're in is, there's sort of a little bit of a rebirth of the small farm. And so we actually, after the farmers markets in town on Thursdays, we have a ritual of going out for beers and dinner with a group of, like, the other young farmers, which is really awesome to you know, talk shop and, you know, see what other people are, you know, dealing with and what's going well and what's not going well. So we, you know, we are lucky that we're in a community that there are some small farmers that are giving it a go, and that our community around here, is able to support local farmers pretty much year round, which I know is not the case in a lot of places. But yeah, no, I hope that it keeps growing, the, you know, the small farming movement. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to, land is expensive. And it's hard to make a profit. And I mean, every year that we do a little bit better, we're like, okay, I mean, this year we wanted to get a bed former for our tractor because we make all the beds by hand, and like, oh, last year we did okay, but we didn't do well enough to warrant buying the bed former. So our fingers are crossed that this year we do better so we can buy the bed former for the tractor next year. Like, there's always sort of, you know, things that, yeah, I mean, it's expensive. We don't make a lot of money, but we make enough to sort of get by and live a comfortable life for us. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I don't think a lot of people get into it, because it's hard to make a sustainable, it can be hard to make a sustainable living.
Yeah, truly. And it's not just that too. It's the lifestyle, and you're tied to your work. You can't leave, you can't do anything. And, you know, that's your life.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've noticed that in the discussion around farming, that the focus has sort of shifted a little towards the smaller micro farms. And I've been really encouraged by what I'm seeing in terms of growing food in cities. So like spin farming and different ideas like that, I think I have so much potential, and I can't wait to see where that kind of thing leads.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, you don't have to be on a big, and like all the urban gardens and community gardens and rooftop gardens, and yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, you can grow pretty much anywhere, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm. I think it's awesome too. So just before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, sort of two questions come to mind. You grow all of your food organically.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is your experience like? Are you, because I know that, especially when you talk to really well-established farmers who've been doing it for a long time, and sort of they grew up in a cohort where pesticides were kind of, you know, part of the farming industry, I guess. And they often say that it's even more difficult to make money when you farm organically, because your plants are so much more susceptible to possibly, you know, pests mostly, I would imagine. And so they sort of not, I don't mean they, because that's generalizing a little bit too much, but it just seems, you know, when I talk to people about it, it just kind of comes up a lot that that's why we don't do it. We do it when we can, but if we have to use chemicals, then we do.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Celine, there are times when I am so jealous of like people that spray, because we've lost, I mean, it's so heartbreaking when we've had a lot of flea beetle issues in the summertime with our brassicas, and they're, you know, we'll spend, you know, all the work that goes into, you know, growing certain crops, and to just watch them get wiped out is, I mean, it's tear worthy. And I'm like, I mean, we've never done this. I joke with him, I'm like, let's just do one round of like, hey, you know,
mm-hmm.
And we don't. And we, you know, even with crop rotation, even with awesome soil, and I mean, yeah, you lose things, and the quick fix is to spray, which the long-term effect, and that's one of the reasons we also, I mean, aside from just what it's doing to, you know, the plants and all of that, but it's just the long-term effects are not something that we're interested in. But yeah, I mean, it's heartbreaking to watch certain pests totally destroy crops that you're totally relying on for, you know, for your customers. So yeah, I get jealous a lot that we don't spray anything, just because yeah, I feel like yeah, losing stuff is not fun.
No, of course not.
Especially when you've put so much time and effort into it. But yeah, we definitely have lost quite a few crops to pests, and I mean, there's also we deal with a lot of deer, so there's also not just the bugs, but just the other predators can be a big deal as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that's yeah.
But you keep doing it though, like, so you're committed to it.
We're committed to it, because we believe. I mean, at the end of the day, because we believe in it, mm-hmm. and it's maybe not the easiest road, but that's the kind of what we've chosen to do. So yeah, we're committed, and we'll
yeah. Well, then I think as well, there's just more integrity behind what you're doing too, because you believe in it wholeheartedly and you're taking the hard way in order to provide a healthier product,
right.
Which I think is so noble. So good job.
Thanks.
So just, was there anything else that you wanted to add just before we wrap up?
I guess, yeah, our biggest mission is just that we want people to really enjoy food and mealtime and like really celebrate, you know, I'm a big dinner we're big dinner people, and just like that ritual of just sharing a really good meal with, you know, someone you love, or even, you know, by yourself. Like, some of my best date nights have actually been by myself and my dog. But just, yeah, really like celebrating good, healthy, nourishing food. And yeah, I don't know, just kind of the end of the evening sort of dinner ritual. I don't know. That's mm-hmm. kind of our favorite time of the day, is that evening sort of sitting down and like clinking glasses and be like, we survived, and now we're eating something pretty tasty. So yeah. And I always like imagine our members, I mean, this is probably so cheesy, but I always like to think of our customers doing the same thing. I don't know if they are, but just, I don't know, kind of imagining where our food is at that moment on someone's table and what they've made. And I don't know. So.
Yeah, it sounds nice. And you should have, you should plan like a dinner at your farm in the summer.
We actually, last year was our first year doing it. We had a,
oh, you did? Nice.
We called it the Rock the Harvest Party. We had a band and we had people come, and it was sort of a picnic style dinner, but it was all of our members, and it was actually really lovely because some of the people, I mean, we don't know a handful of them. And so it's sort of interesting to really like have people come out to the farm and listen to some music. And it was nice, because our members, a lot of them live about an hour and a half away. So it was nice for people to see the operation and walk around and listen to music. And yeah, so, and that was the first annual. So we're going to keep doing that.
Oh, good. Because to me, it just seems like the most lovely opportunity to share, you know, that passion that you have for that relationship between cooking farm to table and the ritual of it and just how much you love it. So
yeah.
That's really nice.
Yeah, no, it is.
So I have one final question for you, and it just popped into my head, and I wanted to just ask you about this, because we spent a lot of time talking about the hardship involved in farming, and that's a huge reality of what you do. It is hard. So, but I wanted to end by asking you what you love most about what you do now.
This is probably going to sound so cheesy, but I love working with my husband. We're together all the time. I mean, it's almost probably unhealthy, but in the wintertime, when he works at the mountain, it's our first time kind of being away, and it's such a weird adjustment. But I love working with him. You know, the days can be hard, but there's these like small moments, you know, at the end of the evening, when we're, you know, kind of finishing up chores and walking around the fields, kind of closing things up for the night, when I just like, we have that like, oh, we're doing it. Like, this is, and there's no one else I'd rather do this with. Like, we're seeing, I don't know, there's, there's the satisfaction in doing it with, you know, your partner in crime. And I guess the other thing that I really, I love the ritual of, you know, the end of the day. You know, it doesn't matter. We're really good about coming in and calling it quits as it's, you know, getting dark out and just sort of enjoying food together. But we get stoked when customers tell us what they made with their food, or when people write us to tell us, you know, that they really loved their boxes. I mean, that feels so good, just to know that, you know, people are feeding their families food that we grew, and we're like, God, who are we to be feeding these families? It's empowering. It's a weird feeling to have, but it makes us feel really proud of what we've decided to do with our lives. And it's great to work together. I don't know.
Well, that was a great answer. I work with my husband too, and it's, you know, I think it does a lot for your relationship and also for you as a person, because you can't just, you know, sometimes it's so easy to just take things out on the people that you love because you know they'll forgive you for it. But in a working relationship, you can't do that. Like, it has to stay functional.
It has to stay functional. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's good to work together, so.
Yeah, exactly. And I love what you said as well about, you know, the thought of your customers enjoying your food and, you know, who are you to do this? It's just, it's awesome. And food sustains life. And so that's what you're doing. You're sustaining life. It's awesome.
Yeah, thanks, Pauline.
So people can find you at dishingupthedirt.com, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then is there another place that's good for readers to go if they want to connect with you?
I'm on Instagram. I do Instagram. I'm really bad at Twitter and Facebook. I'm not that big on, but I'd like Instagram, and then just the blog, dishingupthedirt.com. And that sort of, I keep that up quite a bit. Lots of recipes and sort of ramblings on the farm.
Okay, well, sounds good. Thank you, Andrea, so very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Celine.
So that concludes my talk with Andrea. Please share this episode with anyone you know who would be interested in learning a little more about the farming life. And I hope it inspired you to sign up for a CSA box in your area this season. As always, we've prepared detailed show notes for you over at puregreenmag.com/podcast/Andrea. And she's going to be sending over a beautiful, delicious recipe for Green Goddess chickpea flatbread. So stay tuned for that on our website next week. You can follow her regularly over at dishingupthedirt.com. If you've made it this far and are still listening, I wanted to share a special treat exclusive to our podcast listeners. Our newest issue, Volume 10, themed Heritage, is on press as we speak. Pre-orders are available on the site, and I wanted to offer you a special discount on a 4-issue subscription just to say thanks for listening. Use the code PGMPODCAST10 for 15% off. Again, the code is PGMPODCAST and the number 10, all one word, for 15% off a 4-issue print subscription. Just go to puregreenmag.com/subscribe to sign up. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.